This is Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiotakis. In a fenced parking lot just off the 101 freeway in Rampart Village, a few dozen identical camping tents sit lined up in neat rows. More tents are clustered on nearby sidewalks. It looks like a well-organized sort of official homeless camp in a gritty area surrounded by a messier, bigger, unofficial homeless camp. And yeah, that's what it really is. This is Safe Sleep Village, LA's first ever city-funded homeless encampment.
This is the coffee station, charging station where they can charge any device that they have. Normally that TV is on because everybody watches the news in the morning.
That's site director Wanda Williams providing a tour of the sanctioned campground, which is winding down.
We are able to stay as long as we need to stay until they're, you know, finished doing what they're doing. And then we'll be transitioning these people to a tiny home.
Williams works for Urban Alchemy, the nonprofit contracted by the Los Angeles Homeless Services Authority, LASA, to run this campground as a pilot program. It started back in April. It ends next week. And that's when construction here begins on an affordable housing project. Now, the goal of this government-run campground is to provide a supervised living space and basic services such as prepackaged meals and portable toilets to people who'd otherwise be fending for themselves under the nearest freeway overpass or on the closest sidewalk, and put some folks on the path to real housing.
One of the greatest benefits is that they don't have curfew, and that they're able to come in and out and know that, you know, their things won't be bothered. We're on the street, your things are going to be bothered, you know, people are going to come in.
This first-of-its-kind tent city is going away. But with local leaders under pressure to clear existing encampments and already experimenting with tiny houses and rented hotel rooms, government-run campgrounds like this one are set to become a bigger part of LA's homelessness strategy.
Gotta get checked in.
So, reporter Aaron Schrank went behind the fence on a recent afternoon to see how it's been working.
Many of the unhoused came to this industrial area during the pandemic to get help at PATH, or People Assisting the Homeless, a major service provider directly across the street. Some came for the fentanyl available for sale outside. When Wanda Williams' team arrived in April, they cleared trash from surrounding streets, handed out food, and tried to convince people camped in tents nearby to camp within this fenced-off vacant lot instead.
And we also cleaned this whole entire block, all the way around. So these guys right here, our neighbors over here, they love it because this place was a mess where nobody really was coming back here. Now that we're here, you know, everybody comes to that gate. Everybody comes to that gate for anything, not just the food, for anything. Oh, do you have this? Do you guys have that?
There are no picnic tables or trees at this campground, basically just tents and porta potties. Urban Alchemy covered the existing fence with tarps for privacy and added a security gate. This place is supposed to keep homeless people safe and connect them to services. So has it? Yes, but it's hard to know how effective it's been. Urban Alchemy says it's served a total of 200 people here since April, moving several dozen into tiny homes or referring them to other housing programs. But the people this government-funded tent village is meant to serve give it mixed reviews. First, the positive. Most appreciate being able to safely store their things and access mobile showers 5 days a week.
Things are good. I believe in show and tell. You look at me, you look at people around here. If they look healthy and happy, then obviously we're healthy and happy.
Carlos Lloyd is one of the remaining campers. He's a 56-year-old from Watts who recently served 8 years in prison.
I just got out of prison in January, and I was at a reentry place, and it didn't work out. They put me out, and I was in the streets, in the wilderness. So I met someone that was here late night one night, and they just told me to come first thing in the morning and I can get in. And I've been here ever since.
Lloyd shows me inside the tent that's been his home since August.
Let's check things out. My mother, she wanted to see it on Duo.
Like the others, it's set up inside a 12 by 12 foot white square painted on the asphalt like a parking spot.
It's a four-man tent, actually.
Do they provide you the tent?
Yeah, everything's provided. Everything's provided.
Nice, pretty clean setup
well,
in here.
You know, it's home until we can do better. You know what I'm saying? And so, yeah, I make the best of it.
Lloyd says he definitely feels safer camping here than camping anywhere else.
If you're living in the streets and you have showers, you know, clean clothing, and, you know, being able to, you know, use the restroom, things like that, with some form of security, it's good. It helps out tremendously. It's hard to sleep when you're worried about people doing things wrong to you, you know?
Residents here also get access to hand-washing stations, Wi-Fi, laundry service on weekends, and 3 meals every day.
But the food here is excellent, and it's real. The dietary element of it is tip-top. You can't beat it. Kale and things like that, you know, beans, yeah, it's real healthy.
Lloyd has diabetes and nerve damage in his lower back. His only regular income is general relief payments from the county.
So I'm not able to do a whole lot when it comes to actually working, but things are opening up, and now that we're going to be getting the housing, I can take it from there and put some things together.
He's moving into a tiny home village in Westlake next week, which is also run by Urban Alchemy. The nonprofit runs 2 more campgrounds in San Francisco, where it's based. Deputy Chief of Community Affairs Kirkpatrick Tyler says this model is about creating a safe space for people to reach their goals.
It's what you enjoy. It's what I enjoy, is that at the end of the day, we have somewhere that we can go safe to, you know, get away from the rest of the world. In its essence, that's what our Safely Villages provide. Not perfect. It's not a magic bullet.
Not perfect. Also not cheap. This city-funded homeless encampment cost about $2,600 per resident per month. Tyler says most of that money was spent on staffing. He points out the 6 or 7 men roaming around in black and green uniforms.
Our practitioners that are on site, they do wellness checks just to ensure that, you know, nobody is falling ill or is in trouble.
Staff have to mediate disputes or even evict campers who jeopardize the safety of others. But unlike some temporary shelter programs, Tyler says this tent village doesn't put many restrictions on alcohol or drugs.
All of our interim housing programs are low barrier, which means, like, people don't need rules, they need housing, right? They need support.
The open drug use and the uniformed staff may signal tolerance and security for some people, but others said the staff and drug culture made it difficult to stay. A couple of blocks away on the other side of Beverly Boulevard, I meet a former campground resident named Danye Richardson, working together with a friend to loosen the valve of a fire hydrant and wash some clothes.
You wash too much stuff. What's up?
Richardson says the campground wasn't a good environment for him. He claims he was sober when he went in and using fentanyl by the time he left 6 weeks later.
There's a lot of addicts in there, that's it. The rules was allowing people to indulge in drugs, you know what I'm saying, and alcohol. I didn't think that was a cool thing to do. Exactly. It's like, why would you want people to, you know what I'm saying?
Encourage them
to do that. Yeah, as long as they do it in their tent. And I didn't really, I fell victim to that. Okay, 1 second, sir.
They turned it off.
What you do, Cody?
They turned it off.
Oh, they couldn't have.
Well, they did.
Cody Castro never stayed at the city-sanctioned campground. He's been using fentanyl on the street for the past 4 years and wonders whether people like him can get the help they need at a place like that.
We understand addiction as addicts ourselves, but at the same time, because we are addicts, it makes me more qualified to say that's what's holding a lot of us back. And if the staff's encouraging or just kind of like sweeping it under the rug, how can I escape the environment that's holding me back if I'm re-entering it?
Richardson says he had issues with some of the staff.
It wasn't very professional. Some did take their job serious. Some was very unqualified. You know, it was a lot of incompetence.
He says he was removed from the program after being accused of threatening a woman there. Urban Alchemy says at least 45 campground residents were removed for various reasons. Another 50 left voluntarily. Not all those who left had complaints about the rules. Some were grateful for its presence, even if they opted not to stay.
They fed us 3 meals a day, and they let us be. So, like, what else could you want, you know? I thought it was great.
Mike, who doesn't want to use his last name, had to forfeit his spot in the city-funded campground after disappearing for a few days. Now he's camping just outside the fence. One of his neighbors, named Josh, tells me he joined the campground for a shot at real housing, but got frustrated and left when that didn't happen on his timeline.
And then that was looking like it was never going to happen. I've seen people that are in there for like 8 months, 9 months, sitting in a tent. I've seen some people out there for like 2 months get into a house. It's like, wait, what's going on? Like, I doubt I'm ever going to get anywhere, so.
And a man who calls himself Real Deal, gathering glass bottles for recycling outside of the Safe Sleep site, says he'd never actually stay there, but he's grateful for it.
I mean, it's really cool, though, man. I appreciate what they do. It really helps a lot of people. It keeps them safe, especially girls.
For all of its problems, many people experiencing homelessness did appreciate what the camp had to offer. And local officials in L.A. are already committed to creating more. Urban Alchemy has a contract to operate a Safe Sleep Village with 95 tent spaces along Central Avenue in South L.A., and they say it'll be ready for occupancy by Christmas. For KCRW, I'm Aaron Schrank.
Well, we know there isn't enough housing in California, but will the state's new so-called duplex law help out with that? Senate Bill 9, which signed back in September, will allow duplexes and in some cases fourplexes be built in most neighborhoods now zoned for single-family homes. California is the second state in the nation to take such a direct approach to increasing housing availability. Oregon was the first just a couple of years ago. Now, SB 9 doesn't take effect until the first of the year, but some California cities are already working on measures to weaken it. One of them is Redondo Beach, and we have Redondo's Mayor Bill Brand with us today to talk about why. Mr. Mayor, thanks for being here.
Yeah, and thanks for having me, Steve.
Liam Dillon covers housing affordability for the LA Times. He's been writing about this stuff, too. Hi, Liam.
Hello.
I want to start with you. Because we've talked about SB9 before, but will you, Liam, give us a quick recap? I mean, what does it change about the current landscape of building in California?
Yeah, so I think in many ways, sort of the biggest change with respect to SB9 is almost a symbolic change in kind of the nature of how development could occur in California. You know, right now, almost 2/3 of all the homes in the state or in California are single family homes. And as much as 3/4 of all the developable land in the state, which is obviously a lot, is zoned only for single family housing. And so, you know, allowing for more development, whether it's duplexes or fourplexes in these sort of single family neighborhoods is really a big change.
But I want to be clear, because the law does not prohibit construction of new single family homes, right?
Correct. It just allows that if a property owner wants to build a duplex, and again, in some places a fourplex, that a city can't say, nah, you can't do it.
All right, Mayor Brand, let's bring you in because I want to talk about exactly what your problems are or issues are with the bill, concerns. How do you see it affecting Redondo Beach?
Well, let's first talk about disinformation. I mean, to continue to call this a duplex bill is very misleading. This allows 4 and in some cases up to 8 units next to what has been a single family home. And the lack of information is that there will be no city review on this. There will be no affordable required in any of this. There will be no minimum parking requirements if you're within a half a mile of a bus stop with a certain frequency. So this is an unmitigated disaster for local communities, which is why you're seeing so much pushback from it. So for those of us on the front lines who've been dealing with housing, I've been dealing with it for over 12 years, this is of no help. And this will displace affordable housing, gentrify neighborhoods, and actually be a financial disaster for cities. So I don't even know where to begin, but I'll just kick it off with that.
I guess just the basic question is, why wouldn't more housing be a good thing?
Well, because it's market rate housing. The real crisis in California is affordable housing. And this will actually get in the way of our ability to get more affordable housing. And so, I mean, the state forcing up zonings with no affordability requirement is really in our way. And you talk to particularly the neighborhoods south of Los Angeles, the communities of color, and their communities are going to be gentrified. They're the low-hanging fruit right away for the developers, and here they come.
Liam, Redondo Beach isn't alone in what the mayor is talking about here. You report that other cities are also concerned. Which cities are we talking about, and what sorts of actions are they taking against the bill? And then we'll get from the mayor what he wants to do in Redondo.
Yeah, so I think to be clear, you know, the law does allow in certain circumstances cities to have the ability to sort of, you know, have some limits on whether they want to, you know, allow additional units beyond the 4, right, in the law. But there are some concern, and this is what I've heard from folks at, you know, at the state level, that some of these cities' actions may be, you know, things to try to dodge the law entirely or make it so difficult that nothing would get built. And so, for instance, you know, there was some concern as a proposal proposal in the city of Pasadena that, you know, to build, you would have to put, you know, two mature trees potentially on the property, which could be very expensive. So some things that were sort of seen as kind of overly prescriptive and prescriptive in a way that would potentially prohibit any housing from getting built.
Mayor in Redondo, what are y'all doing over there? I mean, as far as, you know, local ordinances to try and stop this bill from causing that much new development.
We're not doing anything to stop the bill. In fact, we're complying with it. So for the basic person, really, what this means is if you live in a single family home and your neighbor's house goes up for sale, you're not going to get a new neighbor. That new neighbor is going to be outbid by an LLC, other sort of investment group that is going to build it out, and you won't be able to contact the owners. It's an unmitigated disaster for single family zoning and for our ability to get affordable housing. So as I said, you know, the local officials who are in the front lines of this are none too happy. And so we've written an initiative to make zoning and land use a community affair. If people want to read about it, go to ourneighborhoodvoices.com and you will see all the concerns. And these are communities of color that have deep history, deep tradition, that are getting gentrified by Sacramento sending these ill-conceived land use regulations down to the local level. And so that's why everybody's pushing back.
You don't seem to me, Mr. Mayor, as a person who has a problem being candid. So I'm going to ask you this question. Do you think these are well-meaning people in the state legislature who crafted this bill and passed it and it got it signed, who want to help in more affordable housing in California? Or are these people in the back pocket of big developers who stand to gain a lot with this law?
Yeah, well, ding, 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 ding. It's the second one right there. They're taking huge contributions from the real estate associations, the building industry association, and they're not looking out for their local communities. And that's what the local officials have figured out over the last several years, that they're not working with us, right? We all understand that we've got an affordable crisis here in California, and we were looking to the state to work with us, help us fund affordable housing, that sort of thing. But the state took away our ability to fund affordable housing about 10 years ago when they eliminated redevelopment agencies. And many cities were sitting on millions of dollars, and they extinguished our ability to do that. And they've never come back with any way for us to fund affordable housing. So we've been doing it at the local level through inclusionary zoning ordinances, meaning any project larger than, say, 10 units is required to have affordable housing. And then we recently had a project in Redondo Beach, a 300-unit complex, where we mandated 20% affordable as a condition of approval. And the developers accepted it. But that was all done at the local level. The state hasn't done anything except force us to upzone areas for market-rate housing. And that's what's been the big problem.
Liam, you talked to State Senator Scott Wiener, one of the big proponents of the bill. What does he say in response to what the mayor is saying and accusations that, you know, this is a deal for real estate developers and not necessarily trying to get people into affordable housing?
Right. And I don't, you know, obviously don't want to speak for the senator or like kind of have to characterize the entire position of the proponents of the bill, right?
But he's had to defend it.
Oh, yes. No, absolutely. I mean, he and others who are sort of behind the legislation, I guess the most basic version of their argument is there's a shortage of available housing in California overall. And then when you have so much of the state reserved only for kind of one house on a lot, it doesn't make it very easy to resolve that shortage of available housing. And so, again, the basic argument they make is you have to open up these areas around the state for more housing so that, you know, price increases are ameliorated, you know, statewide. And everyone knows who's listening to this, you know, how increasingly unaffordable it is to rent and to buy in California. And they would argue the solution or one of the solutions is at base, you have to have a lot more homes.
A lot more homes, just sheer number of homes. And that's what's going to fix it instead of how much do those homes cost.
Well, I mean, they would argue that if you have a lot more homes, then the homes would cost less.
Yeah. What do you say, Mayor, to people who accuse you and other residents of NIMBYism? That, you know, we don't want more folks in our backyards.
Yeah, so it's funny. Redondo Beach is 11,000 residents per square mile. We're very densely populated. We have a Section 8 program in Redondo Beach. How about that? With the Housing Authority, we funnel about $6 million a year in rental assistance in Redondo Beach. So we basically have it all. We're a very inclusive community, as are many of the cities I'm talked to all up and down the state. I've yet to find a local official say they're not trying to get affordable housing in their town. But we're not interested in Wall Street coming to our town. We're interested in people and residents owning homes, not investment houses. And so we've got to stop this.
Well, I want to thank you both, Redondo Beach Mayor Bill Brand, LA Times staff writer Liam Dillon. Thanks to you both for coming on today and talking about it.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. I really appreciate it, Steve and Lee.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Moving on now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Finishing up some stressful holiday shopping? Maybe just the thought of visiting some members of your family can give you a throbbing headache. So how about taking a sip of a CBD-infused cocktail that tastes like a Capri Sun? Or maybe fill up on some tomatillo aguachile with a side of chickpea-fried hemp in downtown Los Angeles. Mona Holmes is a reporter at Eater LA. She's one of our regulars here at Greater LA, joining us now from a cannabis conference in Palm Springs. It's called Hall of Flowers. Hey, Mona.
Hi, Steve.
I want to get to LA's cannabis lounges in a minute where you can get that Capri Sun, but it sounds like there's a lot going on at this conference in the desert. What's going on over there?
Yeah, it's interesting. This is the first of its kind in Southern California, the Hall of Flowers. They've been operating since 2018 in Santa Rosa. And so this is the first time it's in Southern California. And so there's an entire conference hall full of products, vendors. It's quite a scene, to say the least. There's a lot of people here. But here's what's interesting. I'm finding that there's like this new crop of low-dose, low-effect microdosing products that are emerging right now. For years, it's been this hardcore get-you-stone products that many, including myself, have shied away from because I like being able to function. But now there's something for those who want an entry-level experience with products like honeys, teas, infused foods, anything like that that helps incorporate it into a meal or even a beverage. So it'll be interesting to see how consumers respond to it.
Exactly. And I want to move it back to LA now and talk about some of the things that I mentioned at the outset and some of these new places opening up across Greater LA, one of which is called Gusto Green, right? This restaurant is opening soon downtown, and they're cooking with hemp, right?
Correct. And it's not really the kind of place that's about getting stoned. It's a restaurant that uses the only federally approved hemp grower in the entire United States called ZZ Farms. And so the menu, it's all plant-based or vegan. And it's the kind of experience where, you know, the stereotypical stoner vibe has left the building. It's elegant. It's got a full bar, clean lines, comfortable banquettes. It's a restaurant, period, that serves hemp food.
and again, hemp under 0.3% THC. So you're not going there to get high, right?
That's correct.
Yeah. There's this place called Nostalgia set to open in Santa Monica early next year. They're infusing cannabis into cocktails. Tell us about that place.
I'd love to. I've been tracking Chef Chris Sayeg for over 3 years now, and he's been trying to open a restaurant for a long time. And in the meantime, he's been hosting these private cannabis or THC dinners throughout the city. But Nostalgia is a bar, lounge, and restaurant that's opening in Santa Monica, and it's a culinary take on foods from the 70s up into the early 2000s. Now, just a note, the food will not contain any CBD in any form of cannabis. The chef will have a complete difference in the bar menu where CBD and terpenes are in the drinks. And they're both alcoholic and non-alcoholic. And listeners might remember from way back when seeing CBD cocktails on bar menus a few years back. And then Governor Jerry Brown made them illegal. But just this fall, Governor Newsom signed Assembly Bill 45 that made them legal again.
So neither of these restaurants, Mona, is serving cannabis-infused meals, right? That's still not allowed by law.
Yeah, the laws have been changing since Prop 64 was passed back in 2016, and it's, you know, things have changed considerably. Not putting any cannabis in the food is the law. But how chefs have been working around it is by having private dinners where you're allowed to do that.
Yeah. What about cannabis lounges, speaking of alcohol? I mean, places where you can smoke and eat edibles on site. I'm not talking about the street. And I wonder, you know, we expected this big cannabis lounge boom, but it really hasn't happened. It doesn't feel like it's happened, has it?
No, it hasn't.
Well, I mean, why?
Well, I would blame both the pandemic and the process within West Hollywood. While West Hollywood is the most cannabis-friendly city government that you within all of Southern California, aside from Riverside County. But the pandemic impacted all of hospitality. And cannabis consumption lounges, they follow underneath that category. But the cost of being able to open a lounge these days is very hard. It's super competitive. There's a very lengthy permit application and approval process. And one consumption lounge I owner, or someone who was going to open one, said that both factors, the pandemic and the bureaucracy, made them rethink about doing it in West Hollywood. But having said all of that, this is absolutely moving forward. People will be coming. I remember witnessing it with Original Cannabis Cafe, how excited people were to go there to consume cannabis products on site. But the process itself can be a little bit tricky for business owners and very costly.
Mona Holmes, reporter over at Eater LA, of course, a regular right here at Greater LA. Mona, as always, thanks.
Thank you, Steve. Appreciate it.
That's all the time we have for today. Next week on the show, our street series continues with a history of PCH, Pacific Coast Highway. How climate change could change the king tides. And to get you in the holiday spirit, model trains at Pasadena's Model Railroad Museum. All next week with new episodes of Greater LA. Hey, why don't you tell us how you're doing at kcrw.com/GLA. Tell us how we're doing. Ask any questions you might have. And subscribe to the podcast as well at kcrw.com/GLA. Or you can get the Greater LA podcast wherever you download your podcasts. Again, that website, kcrw.com/GLA. Catherine Barnes, Jackie Sedley, Vincent Nguyen, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Amy Ta, Holly Adams, and Christian Bordahl all help put this evening's show together. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thank you for your ears and time tonight. Have a great night.